The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
Case 35, from Transmitting the Light. The 35th ancestor, great Master Shito, visited Qingyan. Qingyan asked, "Where are you from?" Shito replied, "I am from Cao Chi." Qingyan then raised his posu and asked, "Does this exist in Cao Chi?" Shito answered, "It's not only non-existent at Cao Chi, but it doesn't exist in India either." Qingyan asked him, "You haven't been to India yet, have you?" Shito said, "If I went, it would exist." Qingyan said, "That's not good enough. Say more." Shito replied, "Master, you should say half of it and not depend completely on me." Qingyan said, "I don't refuse to speak to you, but I'm afraid that after this, no one will be deeply awakened." Shito said, "It's not that it will not exist. It's just that no one will be able to express it." Qingyan hit him with the hosu, and Shito was greatly awakened. So here we are, again, sitting in this upright, dignified posture. This powerful posture, this posture of receiving, and this posture of transmitting. By my last calculation, some of us have been here for 18 days, some of us for 11 days, and some of us for 4 days. But as I see it, and I believe my fellow teachers see it, we've passed a threshold where none of that actually matters. We're here for one bell, one bow, just this, one breath. This amazing thing called sesshin. We've talked about it as a container of form that holds us. And what happens in sesshin is the many things, the 10,000 things, the 10,000 grass tips, as Hongzhi calls them, the 10,000 joys and sorrows, all come up into stark relief. The flickering of a candle, so beautiful. The light on the floor, so captivating. I live in this temple, and I never am so enthralled by the light on the floor as I am during sesshin. This is the power of sesshin. The sounds of hammers next door. The smells of dinner or lunch or coffee this morning before 5 a.m. Wonderful. Amazing. I drink coffee normally and don't even smell it. But now, here, it's amazing. It's a gift. And feet on the floor, walking, butt on a cushion, sitting, and inevitably body aching, as mine does, perhaps yours, by the end of the day, sometimes to the point where I can barely stand it. And of course, thoughts, spinning, coming up, passing away, coming up. Memories I haven't thought of in decades. Beliefs, opinions, all floating up. And the good news is, each one of these 10,000 grass tips, 10,000 joys and sorrows, without exception, is a gate, is a doorway to liberation. But we also have relationships with these 10,000 things. They don't just arise and we are passive observers. We prefer certain things. I have a great, great preference for a morning light show, like this morning, when the sun beams through the window over the altar and the leaves rustle and create beauty on the floor. This floor, incredible beauty for me. I've stared at this floor more than I've stared at anything in my life. And wrapped in it is all my joys, all my dreams, all my nightmares. Everything that has ever arisen in practice is blended with this vision of a beautiful, beautiful floor. I also have things that I'm averse to. One in particular, when we dip in our pitch during the Heart Sutra. We did quite a bit of dipping today, and I just kind of went with it. Another thing that, as we're on the roll here, years ago, and it's not this way today and now, but years ago when I came here, particularly for our Angos, our three-week retreats in January, I couldn't stand, or I had such an aversion to the meals that were served as when you go out and get your plates, what do we call this? Oh yeah, when you bring your plates in here and start eating them. Buffet service, that's the word I was looking for. The reason why is the sound of forks scraping across Corel would rattle my teeth. I don't think that would ever occur to me outside of Sashin. But here, everything vibrant, alive. And so we aren't alone experiencing this. This is the great importance of teachers, having teachers, and having teachers like we do, two wonderful Roshis, Dharma holders, senior assistant teachers, assistant teachers. We are a teaching sangha. And for me, that's an incredible blessing. I know for others, they don't like that. They would rather hear from one voice. For me, I have an aversion to that. I think what we offer here as a teacher sangha is an incredible gift. And these teachers are no more valuable than when things start to shift. This is where teachers shine. This is where teachers step forward. Things start to shift in our practice. Perhaps we've suddenly landed on something that we don't like, and we act out of our frustration and break a form. And the teacher reminds us, perhaps in Doksan, perhaps in hallway. And there's an opportunity right there, a doorway, a gateway right in front of us to see how we resist, how we say no, how we are a people of right and wrong. And then when things really start to shift, when things open for us, we have some insight. Then teachers are the greatest resource we have here. Because there's nothing worse than a self-enlightened person. Teachers guide us. They help us. And in some cases, they push us. We are walking the razor's edge. And as we lean too far to one side, they push us to the other and back and forth until we can stabilize ourselves. We might even have great experience, awakening experience, a great insight, and still the teachers are there to guide us. They aren't special human beings. They are just people like us who have walked the way and are just a few steps ahead of us. Maybe several, guiding us. And so in this story of Shito, here he is, an accomplished student with some great insight, meeting his teacher. And his teacher raises a fly whisk. This fly whisk is our teaching. This fly whisk is the culmination of all teachings from Shakyamuni Buddha through the lineage. And it's not just the fly whisk. The fly whisk probably was what he had in hand. Who knows? He could have just held up a hand, said, "Hey." But in that moment, that transformative moment, a moment of transition and a moment of transmission, Shito stepped forward. But he was slightly off the mark. I see these koans, these stories, as a snapshot. A snapshot in this infinite line of teachers. A snapshot in an infinite line of the Dharma, the Buddha Dharma. From beginningless time to the point when the shot was taken to right now. Into the endless future. The story doesn't begin when Shito approaches his teacher. And the story doesn't end when Shito has a great awakening. We are the beneficiaries of the fly whisk. We are the beneficiaries of the awakening of Shito. His lineage carries all the way down here to this Zendo, to this Sesshin. But it's not just that. That's still a limited view. His transmission, his teaching, ripples out through space and time. And saves and heals the world. On the third floor, we have a lineage chart. And you may have received a lineage chart too if you have a Roksu taken, a Jukai, showing the lineage from Shakyamuni Buddha all through the great ancestors and then to you. It's a wonderful piece of art, a wonderful commemorative, but it's not real. It's mostly a fiction, because the real transmission, the line, the lineage, can't be traced with the human mind. It shatters out into the universe to people who don't even practice Buddhism, to every being. Every being is the beneficiary of this great lineage, this great transmission, and the power of this holding up the fly whisk. Now the next thing Shito does is start to respond. And the teacher listens and then says, try again. Try again. Now to me, that is the most powerful and loving thing, a compassionate thing a teacher can do. You're off the mark. Try again. You are worth my time. You are worth my attention. Try again. We may often see our errors as a reflection of ourselves. No. The error is the gateway. The error is the doorway. I've never been hit with a fly whisk. I've never been hit by a teacher, physically. And I don't expect it will ever happen. But I have been hit in the heart, in the mind. And that hitting, usually from a teacher, is in the form of a mirror. A teacher holding a mirror up to me and saying, look. Look, Michael, look. What a gift. What an incredible, compassionate gift. And Shito has a great awakening. But it doesn't end there. It doesn't even end here. At Boundless Way, and at many Zen temples, but here I'm committed with Boundless Way, we have a special relationship with teachers that we can form, called a Shokan relationship. I'm not sure what Shito's relationship with his teacher, if it was a formalized, it might have been, but here we formalize it. For me, that initially felt a little weird and I wasn't interested. Sort of a commitment issue. But then when I saw the benevolence of our teachers, kindness and compassion, as something that wasn't directed to me, it was transmitted to and through me. That the world benefited. A Shokan relationship between a teacher and a student isn't this little cocoon that they exist in. This reverberates throughout the entire world, through space and time. It's how we truly save all beings. This transmission is a mystery to me. And it should be. As Shito says, you who study the mystery, not you who solve the mystery. I can't quite express or understand how powerful a teacher-student relationship in Zen is. I can give you anecdotes, I can tell you things that my teacher has done, but really, it's mostly beyond my awareness and comprehension. It just happens. My mind, my brain, isn't powerful enough, nowhere near powerful enough, to understand and to capture this incredible significance of a teacher-student relationship. We can see it in this koan. We can feel it in the koan. We can feel it and see it in stories. But to describe it, it's a mystery. But I am eternally grateful. And if the world could be, a world could know, the world would be grateful too. Rather than read the koan again to end my talk, I want to read a small poem that kind of illustrates or gives the feeling of me of what a teacher relationship is about. A teacher relationship that's beyond the confines of just the interaction between the student and teacher. A teacher relationship that extends through the whole world and into endless time. This is from the Zen poet and hermit Ryokan. It's called My Teacher. An old grave hidden away at the foot of a deserted hill, overrun with rank weeds growing unchecked year after year. There is no one left to tend to the tomb. And only an occasional woodcutter passes by. Once I was his pupil, a youth with shaggy hair, learning deeply from him by the narrow river. One morning, I set off on my solitary journey, and the years passed between us in silence. Now I have returned to find him at rest here. How can I honor his departed spirit? I pour a dipper of pure water over his tombstone and offer a silent prayer. The sun suddenly disappears behind the hill, and I'm enveloped by the roar of the wind in the pines. I try to pull myself away, but cannot. A flood of tears soaks my sleeves. Thank you. So, please make yourself comfortable and do the horseshoe. Jenny.
Thank you for the talk. When I was Tenzo for the last several coming and going, and that was always my favorite thing at dinner. Pretty much my work is done for the day, and we come in here for dinner, and you hear that clatter of forks and plates, and it was like a rainstorm. It would start off rapid, and then it would down. It's just music, and I've been thinking about that, about my own peeves and preferences, and how many of them are like my peeves or somebody else's delight.
Right, right. And eventually it became my delight, and it's my delight now. I love hearing it. Yeah, and what a beautiful place to enter, right? In a peeve, in a delight. Yeah. Ray.
Yeah, thank you for your wonderful talk. One of the things I enjoy about Sesshin is kind of the openness and feeling that within that spirit of openness that I get insight and, you know, great revelations, whatever things happen. And after a few days, the rubber hits the road, things get hard, and I run into conflict. My ego gets attacked. And I don't like that very much. Because I have been going on with this sense of this image of who I am, and then conflict, irritation. And sometimes, even though I honor the teachers, it's from a teacher. Don't like the way that what they said to me, or how they said it, or how they, whatever, or somebody else, some authority or whatever, says things to me that I don't particularly like, and it doesn't make, and they're wrong and I'm right. And how do I deal with that? That's the kinds of openings that are really strike these, these places in me that I protect so tenderly, and don't like it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. I love what you said in there someplace. I thought I heard Zen is an irritation. It is. It's an irritant. It's like the pearl that gets irritated by being rubbed. And exactly. And we don't like it. And we're here.
And you know, these things, of course you know this so well, happen not just at Sesshin. Right? Everybody knows that. And I'm struck by, the bowls, right? The scraping of the spoons against the bowls. So we can be irritated by non-sentient beings, we call them, right? When we're irritated by sentient beings, things get much more complicated. It's easy to see how the bowls aren't doing anything to us, the spoons aren't doing anything to us. Well, maybe the people who are making the clatter, but that's another thing. But it really can feel like another person is doing this thing to us. Mm-hmm. And then there's the opportunity for division right there. And in a way, as Zen teachers, I think I can speak for all of us up here, we have given over our lives to being used in that way, right? Because it's a great teaching for us too, to see how we're being used as objects of irritation. Right? As well as objects of veneration. You know, that's the other side. It's like two sides of the same coin, right? So, to say what you just said and realize that this is an inner conflict that's provoked by someone else or something else. You know, you remember that Taoist story about the guy in the canoe who sees another canoe coming down towards his canoe, like heading right towards him to crash into it, and he's yelling and he's screaming and said, no, but paddle away, you're about to crash into me. And then the boat comes, there's nobody in it. That's how it is. There's nobody in it.
And to just add to all of this, how we do become more vulnerable in Sesshin, right? I mean, what happens here, of course, is your life, and it's with you all the time. But most of us have gotten pretty good at compartmentalizing, and we don't expose ourselves to situations where we get challenged. Not a lot of us have places where we're always told what to do, like we are here. And as you say, such a treasure. Because, of course, we all think, well, I have very little ego now. I've been doing Zen for a long time, right? And then you come here and you're irritated by the breathing of the person next to you who's ruining your life, you know? And so this container that we hold it and bear, in a sense, bear our suffering. Instead of running away, instead of fixing it, of course, anyone is free to leave. I mean, you're really free to go, but we choose because of some faith. We choose because we've been through it before and suspect that it may not be out there. But, you know, now you see it, hear it. We try not to maintain the irritation, but of course we do. We hold on to our story. But as we are all so lucky, the rubber meets the road and we begin to dissolve, and the ego cannot maintain itself because it has nowhere to stand. And we cry bitter tears and are so grateful.
Steve G.
Thank you for your talk, Michael. I was deeply touched, particularly by the poem at the end. So I lost my grids teacher last year. My mother passed away last year. And you know, this idea that we have of teachers, you know, there's so many teachers that we have. And I think that what I deeply appreciate about so many of the really good teachers that I've had is they let you go. At some point they just let you go. You know, whether it's enough, whether you've learned enough or not, you know. And so, thank you.
Thank you. I remember reading a line in Shunryu Suzuki's Zen Mind, Beginner Mind, that always struck me. He said, as soon as you meet a teacher, you should leave a teacher. All right, so that what he's saying is that it's this, we don't want to cling to the teacher. You know, that this relationship is important, but it doesn't work in Zen, but maybe in just all of life, if we cling to one and a teacher and a student.
Well, and this many teachers, I think, strikes me, you know, Michael, you referred to Shokan, and so there is this special relationship. But the special relationship is at every moment, right? Each time you go into the Doksan room, that is the special moment. Each time you interact with anyone, that is the special moment. The special teacher, where is she? Where are they? Oh, right here. The person who just cut me off in traffic, or the person who, you know, didn't do this or that, parents, friends, enemies, the special teacher is here.
And just to clarify too about Shokan, people do Shokan, make a covenant with one teacher, but then are encouraged to work with all the other teachers too. And then at a certain point, sometimes the teacher and student decide together, or one side or the other decides to dissolve the covenant, and then you can find another teacher, and you don't leave that former teacher, right? You just say, now this happens in a lot of koans. Your karma now is with this person, not with the previous person. So it's not like you get a divorce. It's not like a marriage and then you get a divorce. It's a very unusual relationship that depends on how things are being enacted between the two of you or the two of us. And then at a certain point we think, this has reached its end for the moment. Now I need to go somewhere else. So it's a wonderful living relationship, I think. So just so you know, you're not... If you say, I want you to be my Shokan teacher, that's not it for life. You're not stuck. Yeah. Just like you're not stuck here at Sashin or with Boundless Way. It's okay.
Anne, I saw your hand up.
Oh, yeah. I was just thinking about irritation. When you're in a world and you get irritated with them and you continue to see them, it starts rubbing off. You get to know them and you know why they did what they did. And they do other things you really like, so you sort of forgive that part of it. And sometimes when you're in a car or you're at Sashin and something happens that frustrates you, and then you don't talk to them. So you don't get the surrounding stuff that smooths everything out, which gives you more and more time to build up all sorts of stories, which are more and more absurd. And it's difficult to me being both close to people and yet not talking, mm-hmm. and not being able to get into their head in any mm-hmm. but a superficial one-on-one. Mm-hmm.
Yes, mm-hmm. yeah, it is. And for me, that's why we have teachers. because the teachers help us in that way. And they may be the irritant, but still, that's we have people who have been there and walked that path and seen that and can help us.
And also, and everyone, we don't always want to smooth the irritation out mm-hmm. too quickly, because this goes all the way back to Ray's comment. You know, what's been coming up for me is, this is the Buddha appearing to us, finding ways to free us from our own attachments. We discover our attachments through what drives us crazy, through what irritates. It's often something about ourselves that we're seeing in the other person or that we're reacting to. And, you know, and then it goes on, the very ones, the very attachments that have made us suffer again and again and again. So we've endured so much self-caused suffering because we haven't visited those things that annoy us, irritate us, drive us crazy. And here's the chance, because you can't work it out with the person, here's the chance to sit with it and see what it teaches you, what it has, what Dharma Gate it's inviting you to go through.
Thank you.
Paul.
Thanks for your talk. I've spent a fair amount of my life wanting to be seen and not wanting to be seen at the same time. You know, I was the guy who sat in the back of the room in classes.
Oh.
And, yeah. And yet my career is I'm a professor, a teacher. And I can hide there too. You know, I can have that role. There's just me and everyone else. I think one of the things that I benefited from this practice, and here specifically with my Shogun teacher, Melissa, and just with all of you, is that I am seen, which surprisingly allows me to see better.
Mm.
And I think that's the real gift. It's not about me being seen. It's that once I've allowed myself to be seen, it's like a fog is lifted from my eyes, and I see all of
yeah.
And beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Well, it takes so much effort to pretend that we're not seen. Right? I'm invisible.
Yeah.
And terrifying for almost everyone I know. You know, I think so. Most human beings I know have some deep sense that, well, if you really knew who I was. You know, the outside may look like this, but I better not show up really as myself. And this fiction of not being seen, the ease that can come of just not having to do so much work when we realize the truth, I have been seen, and everyone is still here. You know, it's still brings tears to my eyes to think that, people might really see me and still want to be around. Like, you know, because I'm so crazy and I'm so this and that. And then our heart touched when we stay around long enough and go through the ambivalence. You know, I want you to see me, but don't look at me.
Right.
Don't look at me, but why don't you see me? Mm-hmm. You know?
And we could do that by hiding inside our confidence. I mean, our competence.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we're a competent, addicted culture. So we can stand out and hide with our great competence inside. If I ever failed in public, that would be the end.
Yeah.
Well, and this is just another twist on this whole conversation, but those of us who love to be invisible and still want to be seen, the reality is most people don't care about us. It's a huge narcissism that everybody carries. You know, they saw me do it, and they're really seeing. Those are the two extremes. Right? Most of the time, we're just going along.
doing our thing. It's very, this ties back to what I was saying about being used, right? So this is something I feel like we all have to negotiate inwardly for ourselves. We are visible, but we're not that important. You know, and that's a mind blower, because in our invisibility, we make ourselves important.
Will, you had your hand up?
Thank you. I guess I mean, maybe the answer to my question is trust, but you know, I get the veneration, of course. I feel the, you know, the kind of awe and the incredulity that there are people who have given their lives to the Dharma. And as Melissa said, what's in it for you? You know? And it's astonishing. And so also is the fact I, with the irritations, I find myself thinking, you know, we all came here to obey orders for a week. You know, we didn't have to do that either. So that framing helps it, you know. But I guess it's sort of the question of how do we, you know, have this sense of the extraordinariness of teachers, the importance of teachers, without feeling like teachers are a separate species that, you know, have nothing in common with us.
Mm-hmm.
You see, because
yeah.
It does seem like the one could suggest the other very easily.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, Will, I think that's such an important point about the equality that has to be there. Because to imagine the teacher as some, well, the teacher really knows what I should do.
Right.
The teacher does not know what you should do. Really, I'll let you in on the secret. The teacher may be able to meet you where you are, may be able to explore with you the truth that is arising. But the truth that arises is not the teacher's truth. So there has to be, I love this trust, but I hope you don't trust me. Right? I hope you trust you.
Yeah.
Right? And it's not that, you know, I hope I do piss you off sometimes and irritate. And in that context of the trust, what is happening, what has happened? Right? And then the resonance we're looking for is not the teacher's resonance. Well, you know, good for them. I hope it's a nice life. But my life, my truth.
And just a clarification here, too, based on the story from yesterday about that teacher, you know, is this a scam? We were talking among the teachers, and I can't remember which meeting this was, whether it was just the transmitted teachers or the senior assistant teachers too. This particular guy did have an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
He was a sexual predator, and one of his agendas was he was grooming young women to have sex with them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the guy at the top of the mountain that you had to run up to, same thing. And then we made a list of all these Zen teachers. Some of them, you know, that we've all studied with, who did have an agenda. It was a scam, in a way, right? And so I want to say that that's got to be true for the four of us as well. My learning as a teacher is to keep seeing, what is my agenda, right? Is it just transmitting the Dharma, or is there something else from my neurotic brain, you know, I don't know. But to keep waking up to it in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
And just like, you know, every mistake is a learning, sometimes that's revealed, because David said, you know, well, I show myself and people want to stay with me. That's wonderful. Well, actually, if you know the history of Boundless Ways In, it's not true. People left and they were pissed. And some people stayed, and you know, that was another wonderful, horrible teaching. What is it called? an afflow, another fucking learning opportunity. And everything is like that, everything. And I've been thinking, oh, this sesshin is amazing. The sangha is so strong, and we're sitting still, and we're, you know, by this point in the sesshin, this doesn't always happen, the corrections, if you call them that, are so infinitesimally unimportant at this point, you know, because really, it's the thing is happening. But I was thinking, well, don't cling to this, because this will never happen again. This particular group of people, we will not be here. There'll be other people, some of us won't be here. So to be fully present to this opportunity, and I want to go back to what Alan was saying about, in response to Anne, you know, I had the thought, I thought you said it so well, but I just kind of want to underline it. When these irritations arise, we're not trying to smooth things over. We're not making nice. We're not trying to work things out with people. Mm. We're trying to work things out with ourselves and our own hearts. And that's what I meant by the boat story. Like, the characters in the play are, everybody's got their role to play in the drama of our own lives. They don't know that. It's all in here. And so we can work these, we can be awakened by everything, with no exceptions.
I also want to add that there are Zen teachers and other spiritual and religious teachers who set themselves up as kind of different from human or different from, you know, and they do things like make people run up hills. And that's not what we do. So as I heard you, you know, I was thinking, yeah, but you don't really think that, because we have a tradition in Boundless Ways, and Melissa just illustrated it, of exposing ourselves, mm-hmm. you know, of exposing our humanity. And I remember my first year with Boundless Way, I mentioned James Ford yesterday, and James Ford gave a Dharma talk, second year, that blew me away, because he talked about how he'd had an anxiety attack and had to go to the hospital thinking it was a heart attack. And I couldn't believe this. You know, like, Zen masters are supposed to hide these things. Mm. I couldn't imagine Richard Baker Roshi telling the Sangha he had an anxiety attack. Me feel anxiety. You know, and it was so deeply human. And if I hadn't already been completely enamored of Boundless Ways in, that would have done it. You know, and I've heard everyone up here do something like that. We don't pretend that we're anything other than fully and comically and tragically and beautifully human.
And I think we're all responding so much because this is a core thing, right? We could be idealized for doing that. We're going to get used no matter what. Yeah. So, Melissa, she's so great. She talks about her headaches and her aging. And isn't she wonderful? And you know what I mean? If people are going to idealize another person, they're just going to do it. And it's been really...
That was sort of my question.
Yeah, it's kind of, for me personally, it's been surprising to see that any projection is fake. Nobody knows me. I don't even know myself.
And yet to see another human being is astonishing. You know, when someone lets you see them or you just see them, you know, again, there's your teacher. And yeah, easy to think they have it and I don't, but there is this other way of really appreciating the humanness, the full humanness, that any idealization you project on any of us or anyone else is part of you. Some people said, oh, you're so kind and gentle. Yes. And you're seeing that because you are kind and gentle. I am a part of you, and that wonderful mirror that reflected, I think, Michael, that you were saying. So yeah, and you're ruining my life, and you're a terrible person. Well, not really. That's you too. Yeah. So. Yeah.
Deb, one.
This just made me think. The first time I met Roshi Kaplow was at a little workshop thing, and he said to me, he said, "About time you got here." And of course, I thought, "Oh my God, he's a Zen teacher." You know, he sees right through me. Yeah. I mean, and it was like this is a god, you know, kind of thing. And I feel like this Sashin, I really see you teachers as people. I mean, even though I've been coming for years, I mean, a couple of years, it just feels like there's like this little switch, you know? And then
You're welcome.
Yeah. And then another little thing about irritation in marriage. When I do the dishwasher, Matt always fixes everything. He's, you know, and we just laugh about it. And someone sent me this cartoon. I think it was from the New Yorker. In a marriage, there's one person who loads a dishwasher like an architect, and there's another person who loads it like a raccoon on crack. The one thing is, even though, you know, there's irritation that he's fixing it, and he's irritated because I'm not doing it right, it's, you know, we can laugh about it, and there's joy in our, in that, but we had a long marriage.
Thank you. One more, Todd?
Yeah, I was just going to comment, what's come up for me is that, you know, certainly there's skill in being a teacher. There's also skill involved in being a student, I think, as well. And so just wanted to add that to the conversation.
Absolutely.
Can you speak about what you see that those skills as? I'm just curious.
As a student?
As a student.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think... knowing how to relate to a teacher in an honest way and being, you know, again, just being able to be present and to see the teacher as a teacher in the role as a teacher, and that teachers are students too, or at least I'm both a student and a teacher, so I can speak for myself in that. Yeah, so there is a skill that grows over time, I think, as a student and working with teachers.
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad I asked you.
A friend of ours once said, a poor student needs a good teacher, but for a good student, any asshole will do.
On that note. Please restore the Zendo.